Welcome to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. I am Dr. John, the guide for your heroic journey towards greater health, success, and most importantly, happiness. And now, on with the show. Hi, this is Dr. John, and I am thrilled to announce that Jory and I are opening up our retreat in beautiful Costa Rica from September 28th of 2024 to October 5th. Everyone wants fulfilling relationships. The hard part is love is not enough. So many factors can get in the way, preventing ongoing connection, intimacy, and aligned growth. All healthy relationships start within. But when we have unresolved stuff, it can easily interfere with those we are seeking to be closest with. Whether you're in a long-term committed partnership or are single and are looking for love, this retreat will guide you in the heroic journey of healing yourself so that you can be open and available to cultivate the fulfilling relationships you desire and deserve. To find out more, visit joriroese.com/retreats. That's joriroese.com/retreats. Hey, everybody. This is Dr. John Schinner, back with another episode of the Evolved Caveman Podcast. And today I am pleased to be with my partner in life and love, Jory Roese.
Hello, everyone. So glad to be here. I love our conversations.
And today we are continuing our mini series on Love Isn't Enough to kick off our new website, loveisn'tenough.net. And the topic today is core wounds. So what are your core wounds as an individual that show up and make your life miserable in your romantic relationships?
So I'm going to give some context to this, John. So I love doing couples work. I find it to be a big puzzle in which we can figure out what is the areas or barriers that are getting in the way of connection and intimacy and safety and growth. And one of the very first things I always ask couples that I'm working with is, do you know what your partner's core wounds are?
And people look at you and go, what?
I actually would say about 50% may actually know. It really is a pretty good percentage.
It's a difficult question.
It's a difficult question because it's actually many people don't always know their own core wounds, let alone what their partner's core wounds are. And the reason I'm so curious about this is because when we know what our partner's core wounds are, then we can do our very best to be sensitive to what our partner gets most triggered by or is sensitive to so that we don't activate it. And yet we know we're going to disappoint people.
So you mean you don't want to get angry and attack their core insecurity?
Ideally, no. That is the goal, people. If you know your partner's deepest wound or insecurity and you are intentionally attacking it, we've got some other work to do first.
I've been doing it all wrong.
You've been doing great. But I guess maybe we can start with our own selves before we jump into the stuff, because in our Love Isn't Enough model of working with couples, we really have this, if you've been listening to our stuff, you know what I'm going to say, this ongoing interplay of self-work and relational work. And we know if we're not doing our own individual work, it doesn't matter how good the relational tools you're learning.
Trolls or tools?
I was going to say tools and I don't even know what the word was coming up. So yeah, trolls.
Relational trolls.
Relational tools. Maybe it's a Monday, John. Cut me some slack.
I just want to be clear for the audience.
My core wound of insecurity. Can you be a little gentler with my mess up of my words, please?
Honey, I think you might have misspoken.
I did. It was not relationship trolled. Okay, back to the point. If we don't know what our core wounds are likely our partner doesn't. But here's the thing, when we know that and we can have the self-awareness to be sensitive to it, we can get through difficult moments much more gracefully, staying a little more connected than disconnected. And it leads to greater healing and ultimate growth in the relationship, especially when there is a disconnection.
Well, one of the things that fascinates me, I was just thinking about our core wounds, and it fascinates me the extent to which these core wounds. Because I was going to say, well, my core wounds only show up maybe 5% of the time or less. Like, they're not that pervasive. They don't show up all the time. And I think that's
true. He's also done a lot of work on that too.
Yeah, well, but I also think that's true for a lot of people. But then I think of people that have
you know, a lot of insecurities about being in a relationship, being betrayed. And those insecurities are more pervasive and they are going to show up far more frequently. And mm-hmm. so it was just an interesting thought that it may only show up in very limited moments, or it may show up kind of across the board, depending on what that wound is.
So that would be a great question of not only knowing the core wound, but to what extent do you feel it's getting in the way of your day-to-day stuff? Because I would say for you, when I first met you, I think some of your core wounds were a little bit more present, more than 5% of the time. And then I'll be gentle in how I choose to answer that. But I think as you've done deeper work on yourself and we've done deeper work on our relationship, I really only see your core wounds showing up when there's deep trigger of activation of some kind or rumination. Rumination can get us stuck.
Yeah. So my core wounds, I would say, are unworthiness, shame, and that shame being a belief that I am unworthy of love, connection, and belonging.
Right.
And they used to show up. That used to show up in when we would get into a longer disagreement.
Right.
And where we would get stuck.
And you shared that before, where then it would turn to that belief of I'm not good in this relationship. She's better off without me. Which we've also talked about how then it would lead to avoidant attachment styles and pushing me away and shutting down. And thank you for doing your work around that. That's gotten much better. My core wounds is ultimately abandonment, fear of being alone. And when I have that core wound come up, I tend to want to grasp and cling tighter. So that becomes that anxious attachment style. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of interesting because to keep it really, really simplified, I often see people's core wounds either being, I'm not enough or I'm too much. Mm-hmm. I mean, would you agree that to some extent.
Yeah, which causes you to either pursue or retreat.
Right. Right. And I know there's a lot more core wounds, but I don't want to oversimplify people's complex lives and histories. But when we can look at it from a lens of simplicity, we're afraid we're too much. I'm too needy. I'm too emotional. I have too many requests. I want too much time. And the other side of it is I'm not good enough.
Yeah.
I'm unworthy.
And one of the reasons I wanted to do this conversation with you is to go through some of the possible core wounds to give people something of a beginning menu to look at what might my core wounds be.
Yeah. And I want to give some context a second back to doing couples therapy. And the reason I ask this question is because I think people are often getting triggered by their core wounds more than they even realize. And here is the reason. If you're not aware of it and don't have the ability for self-awareness, self-reflection, and agency over naming and owning where you're stuck, it's going to come out looking like what?
You're going to externalize that shit.
See, I love talking with you because you can just fill in the blanks and
it's
feel like
all your fault. If you would just stop being so needy, I wouldn't be so angry. If you would just stop being such a bitch, I wouldn't be so pissed off. If you would just stop being such an asshole, I wouldn't be so mad.
Right. So in absence of that awareness, we're externalizing blame. We're projecting. We're not taking ownership and accountability for what I'm actually feeling. And now the issue isn't about the real issue. Mm-hmm. Well, it creates a whole new set of issues. Well,
and that is, you know, and you hear this line in counseling a lot, like anger's only a secondary emotion, which I don't buy into. I think anger can be a primary emotion. But in these instances, I think anger is a secondary emotion where anger is often following on the heels of insecurity or hurt.
Right.
But it happens and it's so fast. It's a third of a second. Right. And so we don't even realize that there's an emotion underneath our anger that would be far better to speak to than anger.
And that would require, again, self-awareness to know what you're feeling, ability to self-regulate your nervous system, to calm yourself down so you can speak effectively. And these are tools that we can learn. These are possible. They're just not always easy, especially in the heat of the moment, which goes back to some of the things that we've said from the Gottman's work, that when you're disconnected, when you're in an argument, when you're fighting, you only have one goal: regulate.
Well, it also makes me think of that tool that you and I have talked a lot about, that kind of positive upward virtuous spiral of revisiting disagreements that we've had when we're calm.
Yes.
When we can be curious, when we can be less judgmental, and going after these things with curiosity, primarily in ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, like for me, like, gee, why did I get angry when Jory came home from Ecuador? Like, that doesn't really make any sense.
Right. That, like, curiosity
what,
is huge.
What might be going on there for me that has nothing to do with this relationship and Jory, but maybe had to do with my prior relationship and more likely had to do with my childhood.
Right. Because it's that childhood and where our brain gets wired for understanding love and relationships. So we then see things through that lens.
And then once we start to uncover some of that, be like, oh yeah, my parents used to leave me somewhat frequently and they would go away for long trips and leave us with babysitters. And that was kind of semi-traumatic for me
because feel safe.
Incidents that happened. And once I can bring that to the surface, it gives me more understanding for myself and my own triggers, but it also gives you more understanding and compassion for my triggers.
Right. And then greater ability to resolve it more relationally. Uh-huh. So before we jump in, given what you just said of that ability to revisit, can you describe your own journey on what that's been for you? Because I think this is so, it's always so helpful to remind couples, because you used to get really annoyed when I would bring something back up.
Oh, it was awful.
All I was trying to, like, I came from the mindset of, look, I don't care if we're disconnected. Well, I care, of course. I don't mind if we get disconnected or into an argument, as long as we learn something from it and we can grow from it. Like, it's going to happen. So at least let's make it useful for our relationship.
Well, and I think in the beginning of our relationship, we would get in a disagreement. We would get it to a resolution, or I thought it was resolved. And then, you know, a day, two, 3 days later, we'd be on a walk and you'd be like, hey, can we go back and talk about that argument that we had a few days ago? Because I'm not really feeling 100% resolved. And when that first came up, it was like the eye roll internally. It was like, oh shit, like we got to talk about this
that
again.
That wasn't just internal love.
No, I said the eye roll and then the response was external.
Yeah, the eye roll
was external. That was completely.
Yeah. But sometimes you would say, ah, oh, shit, I thought we were done with this.
No, because I didn't want to go into another uncomfortable conversation.
Well, and you likely didn't want to get re-triggered and you didn't want to have to go down that spiral.
Yeah. And so I was afraid of having that emotion come back up.
Right. And so you were self-protecting. Uh-huh. If we look at what was happening.
Of you underneath. And us.
Right.
Of me, you and us. But over time, I realized that, no, this is actually a really good tool.
Strategy, yeah.
To go back and revisit these talks. And one of the things we learned from Charlie Bloom, which I think was brilliant, you know, if one of us isn't complete in a disagreement, then the relationship isn't complete. Right. Neither one of us is complete. We can't get complete. We can't get to true resolution until we're both resolved. So if one of us is having emotions that keep coming up about it, or thoughts that keep coming up about it, then it's important to go back and take another look at it.
Right. Which requires grace from the other partner to say, wow, I see you're still feeling stuck. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to keep working through this. It may not be easy, may not be fun, but I understand that.
Yeah,
there's something to learn here until we can both get there.
Pulling back your perspective and knowing that this is the best strategy for dealing with these long-term or difficult conversations or issues, because I've really seen it's made a huge difference for us over the long haul, where we've actually come to resolution on a number of issues where we can finally put them to bed and just put them in the past.
Mm-hmm. And to be honest, that may have taken 2, 3, 4 times.
Mm-hmm. Or more. I don't even know.
Right. But the further distance you get from the triggered conversation, the greater ability you're going to have to get to that point of resolution because your nervous system won't be as activated. Mm-hmm. So, kind of going back to what I ask new couples is, what is your partner's core wound? And if they're not really sure of that, what does that even mean? Then it's another way of saying, okay, where do you have your deepest insecurities or insecurities or wounds or pain points?
Yeah, it's also kind of
traumas,
looking for patterns of where you get triggered.
And that
takes some work too.
Sure. Because again, if you're used to externalizing, well, I don't get triggered. I just don't like just being a bitch. I don't get triggered. I just don't like it when he's angry.
I always assume the positive intentions with my partner.
Yeah. And then we see that, you know, it gets externalized and that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And that's common. And look, you guys, none of this is going to be a one and done. This is really an opportunity for exploration into yourself so that you are more present and available with your partner.
And I think a big piece of this is practicing radical accountability for one's own shit.
Yeah.
Like if it's my anger, it's my issue.
Right. Well, we also love that phrase. I think it's a Terry Real comment that if it's hysterical, it's historical. So the more activated you get, the longer it's likely been stuck inside of you.
Yeah, the more likely it is to go away in your past.
But I do want to say, you know, part of what this looks like in practice is one of the things I absolutely love most about you, John, is how deeply you feel. And at times it can be one of the most frustrating things.
Yeah, it cuts both ways.
Because it can make you highly sensitive. And 95% of the time, I think that's one of your greatest strengths. It makes you a great partner, a great father, and allows you to do your work so effectively with clients. But my point in saying this is I also know that when it's a strength, it can also be deeply activated, but it's also my accountability, my own agency around how to best communicate with you about that. So like my ex, for example, wasn't as highly sensitive, or if he wasn't in ways that didn't show up in the ways that you might feel that. So I had to learn if I want to be able to be heard or get a need met or have a request, it was up to me to communicate to you in the best possible way you could hear it. Showing up bluntly and stating it was never going to be the way for you to be able to receive any feedback or a request. Mm-hmm. So knowing his core wound of sensitivity and worthiness gave me information of how to best communicate to you.
Well, and it's interesting because that sensitivity and self-worth was also tied into my deep emotional sensitivity.
Right.
Because to me, when I couldn't manage my emotions in those moments, I was like, screw it.
Right.
I shouldn't be in a relationship.
So that's an example of how I would attend to your core wound or deepest insecurity or sensitivity. What would be one that you would shift knowing what mine was?
Well, I think knowing that it's abandonment and insecurity over abandonment, I try to over communicate with you. Mm-hmm. I try to let you know when I'm leaving, when I'm home. I try to let you know where I'm at. And that's all of my choosing.
Right.
Like it's not.
You're not on a tight leash.
It's not. It's something I do because I love you and I want you to feel secure. Mm-hmm. And so I intentionally over communicate with you to let you know we're connected and things are good,
right,
to put you at ease.
And sometimes that can come up as a challenge. And we've seen when we've gotten into arguments where you've needed space to regulate and I seek a connection to regulate. Mm-hmm. And when you've needed space, I've had to learn really hard to not over-personalize your need for space because it does trigger my abandonment wound. And that's a great opportunity for me to practice my own tools on taking care of myself, which comes back to that constant interplay of self-work and relational work. And I remember years ago, we got super cheesy and instead of the line from Jerry Maguire of I complete you, which we know kind of screwed up a lot of relationship, the feeling incomplete without a partner, a way of saying I love you was I co-regulate you. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like two therapists in love having, psychobabble of expression of love. But at times we can't co-regulate each other. Doesn't mean I don't love you.
The goal is to help each other co-regulate to co-regulate one another.
And also know when your partner's not available and not mm-hmm. over-personalize that.
Well, and then the self-worth comes into play, right? The self-soothing, like I'm okay. He still loves me. He's not going anywhere. Take a deep breath.
Right. And we also know from research for those who do need alone time to regulate, to let their partners know the time frame in which they will return.
Yeah.
Hey, love, I need some time. I'll be back in 20 minutes or I'll be back in an hour. The Gottman's research says minimum 20 minutes because that's what we need to regulate our nervous system, maximum 24 hours. Yeah. And stay connected if you can during that time. So let's go into some of these idea of people's core wounds.
Okay.
To give others, because, my hope is that for people listening to this, they really can get curious about themselves if they haven't already. And then bring that to their partner.
Yeah. So let me do the one. So these basically are mapped onto attachment styles.
And since,
a secure attachment style would have few, if any, of these core wounds, but I think it's still possible. This is basically anxious and avoidant attachment styles. So since I was more avoidant, let me do the avoidance.
Perfect.
And you can do the anxious.
That sounds great.
So some of the common vulnerabilities for avoidant personalities or avoidant attachment styles are feeling intruded upon. So if you get annoyed when your partner comes in, you're working at home on the computer and they ask you a question and you're like, why are you always interrupting me? Or can't you see I'm in the middle of something? That can be a vulnerability. Feeling trapped or out of control.
Can I go back to the feeling intruded upon?
Yeah.
How do we know what's going to trigger a wound there or when I actually need you on time and space? For someone who has a trigger there, but like, I don't want to interrupt you, but yet I need something. How would that work?
Well, I think number one, you don't come in loud.
Okay.
You come in gentle.
Okay.
Quietly.
The soft and startup semi approach.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to me, it's like, hey, honey, can I talk to you when you have a break?
Okay. Can you let me know when you're available?
Yeah. Because there's something about attention where I can go deep into what I'm doing. Ideally, I don't do this quite as much as I used to because I can't see for that long, but that's a whole other
thing. Right. Like if you're reading or working.
Right. If I'm writing something, I can go way into that and I can go into that for a couple hours and I like being there. And to pull myself out of that takes effort and energy.
Right.
And then to refocus on whoever's interrupting. I remember having, when my kids were small, this used to drive me nuts. Mm. Because it took a tremendous amount of energy to pull out and focus on them and then get back to where I was.
Takes a lot of effort and attention too.
And it annoyed me. So I think, you know, again, part of this is gentle communication. Part of it's volume. And part of it, for me, my work in this is reminding myself that there's no foul being committed here.
Mm.
They're just trying to get my attention.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't personal. It's not. And I've had to work on this over the years that, you know, it used to annoy me much more. Now I'm pretty good about it.
Right. I think it comes back to that interesting idea of feeling positive intent, assuming positive intent. If I assume someone doesn't respect me, then any intrusion on time or space might feel like a greater offense.
Well, and I think this is a great example of that interplay between self and relational work,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, how do I communicate with my partner in a way that's going to best be heard?
Right.
And then as the receiver of that, how do I work within myself to make sure that I'm receiving my partner's communication in a way that doesn't hurt their feelings or drive them away?
Right. And I call that the reciprocity of needs, right? If I can meet your needs, I'll have a much likelihood of getting my needs met in return. But I want to give like real tangible examples for mm-hmm. each of these. So I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay.
So the next one is feeling trapped. And you know, you could also say feeling out of control, but I at times will get that feeling of claustrophobia. And it can
emotional
be
claustrophobia.
It could be actual claustrophobia, like sitting in a MRI with my shoulders right. pinned in a small tube. I don't like that at all. But then I can also
about a small elevator in Italy in a 200-year-old building.
No, I'm okay with that.
We had a bad experience.
That's more horrific.
That's my feeling trapped.
But I think it extends to emotional and relational claustrophobia.
Mm-hmm.
And even like we've had conversations about me leaving your house
mm-hmm.
where that has a claustrophobic feeling to me. Like I just want to say goodbye and leave.
Mm-hmm.
And you get sad and a little bit anxious when I do leave and you like to drag it out. And mm-hmm. so there's competing.
I like a
needs.
Couple of goodbyes.
Yeah. But I mean, and there's no wrong there.
Right.
And you want to be aware of where those needs are in competition so that you can talk about it and know where your partner's coming from.
I know one of the areas this has come up for you a couple of times, and I think it just kind of was by happenstance in which we've had conversations in the car
mm-hmm.
and that has caused you to feel very much trapped, mm-hmm. that you had no escape, that you couldn't.
Well,
your space.
Part of that goes back to adolescence
right.
and some experiences I had there too. So there's a double hit.
So
there.
Again, without that knowledge, I could easily over-personalize mm-hmm. that or judge you for it or get mad at you for it or dismiss it. Like, what the fuck is wrong? Like, what's the big deal here?
Right.
And I remember a couple months ago, we had a conversation in a car that was difficult. And I ended up pulling over to give myself in a moment to regulate. And you assumed I was there to trap you.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to reassure
well,
you.
It felt like I was being trapped.
Yeah. Right. And that was your old story. Mm-hmm. That wasn't what was occurring. I just was taking time to regulate while driving. And this is where being able to communicate that effectively could have spiraled into a big fight. And it really wasn't. We were just both having an internal trigger.
And we see this a lot in couples where mm-hmm. they'll have a disagreement in a car and one of the two will feel trapped mm-hmm. and like want to get out of stop the car. Like I'm out. Like, and they'll like on the freeway.
Right.
Like, right. I don't think that's a good idea.
Well, in the opening scene of Crazy Stupid Love, Steve Carell just rolls out of a moving car. So he felt really
well. So there must be some fruit there, right?
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on.
All right. So the third of four for avoidant attachment styles.
Not a complete list, is your starter.
And so the next one is fear of too much intimacy. And I think this one fascinates me because when you fall in love with someone, you open your heart to them, you open your past, you expose your insecurities, you expose your weaknesses, expose your vulnerabilities. And it's amazing. And simultaneously, it's terrifying because basically what you're doing is you're gift wrapping your heart and handing it to this person and saying, please treat this gently. Mm-hmm. And then you have to trust that that's the case. But then inevitably you're going to get into disagreements mm-hmm. where that heart is going to get hurt. That's just how it works.
Right.
And so I think, you know, to go back to assuming positive intent, working through these disagreements multiple times to come to completion, I think working on forgiveness mm-hmm. of your partner in those situations repeatedly is a good idea as well.
Compassion yeah. for the other. I see the fear of too much intimacy. And again, this is kind of being grouped from what would be named as an avoidant attachment style. So mm-hmm. you got to have understanding that this was likely from early on in childhood in which the primary caregiver was physically or emotionally not present. Mm-hmm. And so that child's brain gets wired in a sense of, I must not be lovable enough. I can't trust others. I'm going to take care of myself before, you know, I over-rely on someone else because they may not be there and they may let me down. So I'll push someone away before they have a chance to hurt me. Yeah. So it's very, very self-protective. And the more self-protective we are, the less connected we can be yeah. in an intimate relationship. So, you know, this fear of too much intimacy, if I'm going to generalize, sorry, everyone, I see more men mm-hmm. have that fear, but we also know that's how they've been socialized.
Right.
So we've got to look at this from so many different angles. If men have been socialized to be autonomous and women are socialized to be more relational and women are just trying to stay connected, the men can be like, lady, give me some space.
Stop trying to control me.
Right.
Yeah. And then the fourth and final one for avoidance is the fear of being blamed.
Mm.
And you know, I kind of will put this in the same category as I don't like to do things wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I fucking hate to disappoint you or hurt you. And so when I have done something wrong and I have hurt you, that is really difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think was the most likely entree into shame. And that was a big aha for us as well, I think, because, mm-hmm. you know, if you know that's the case with your partner, then you know they're doing everything they can pretty much mm-hmm. not to disappoint you, not to hurt your feelings. And yet it's inevitable and it's going to happen.
Well, and part of the grace around that is recognizing sometimes what felt hurtful to me was taking care of your own self.
Mm-hmm.
So without insight into those core wounds of what you were working through, like, look, everyone's needs can't be met all the time.
No.
And so again, I keep coming back to this word of grace. Let's just have some spaciousness and some compassion that it's a fucking miracle any relationship mm-hmm. works. I mean, we are feeling beings who don't always think clearly, who have a myriad of wounds and traumas. And for any of you, especially men listening, who don't believe you have traumas, you're not looking at yourself with the lens through understanding how experiences have impacted you.
Well, and again, I like Faith Harper's definition of trauma as anything that disconnects us from a feeling of safety. And growing up in the man box culture, we got that shit all the time.
Right.
That was just, that's daily existence.
I mean,
for us.
John, now, no.
And so it's an accumulation of small t, little t traumas,
right.
I would say generally, but they're still there. They accumulate.
But you know, I know you know this, and especially you see this when we do couples work together, in which I will hear the woman or the wife in the relationship say, oh my gosh, my husband has so many traumas he's not willing to address or to look at. And then I'll say, hey, John, go talk to him about, you know, what his traumas are. And he's like, I don't have any.
I'm fine.
I don't, what do you mean? I don't have any trauma.
Yeah.
So we can see how this really interferes again with connection and intimacy and vulnerability and growth. So let's move on into some common vulnerabilities of what might be the anxious attachment. And it was kind of funny as we read, you know, some of these this list together. I'm like, oh fuck, this is you and I to a T. Damn. The good news is, you guys, secure attachments are possible. So just because you might have had a pattern or a history of anxious or avoidant does not mean you're stuck there.
And that's the goal, is to create a secure attachment style with the right partner by going after some of these insecurities or all of them and vulnerabilities.
And let's again get vulnerable for a second. We've been together 8.5 years.
We haven't been vulnerable already?
No, we're getting more vulnerable. In 8.5 years, I would say that old anxious avoidant attachment was present for at least seven and a half of those years.
Yeah.
I would say in the past year, which really post breakup and doing deep dive into self-healing, have we been able to develop a secure attachment?
Yeah.
And what percentage would you say you feel secure with me?
99.5.
Yeah, me too. Those triggers are really small. So let us be evidence of when you do the healing. I don't want to call it work. I hate the word relationship work. Even though it is work, it just has a negative feel of drudging.
Yeah.
It's curiosity. Yeah. It's relational investment. Investment growth. Okay. New word. Okay. So for the person in the relationship who has a tendency towards anxious attachment, one of the triggers is deeply rooted in fear of being abandoned. Mm-hmm. And this can be by simple not acknowledging bids for attention. So it could be very slight bits of feeling dismissed versus not feeling as important. So kind of a conceptual, you don't take me into consideration versus like actual leaving me.
Not being listened to. Yeah, taking a time out during a fight can trigger it.
Being broken up with.
Well, that kind of is abandonment.
Well, and that was a really tricky one, right? I mean, yes. You know, when we say that, you know, you try your best not to activate your partner's deepest wounds or insecurities, that was one of my biggest challenges during our short breakup was like, was that the only route you could go, John? And, you know, like, did you have to break up with me? Because that deeply activated my core wound of abandonment. And we've done a lot of work of healing around that. And I know it was necessary. We had a, you know, we needed that breakup. And the healing around that has been strong. Mm-hmm. So, but this, you know, can really get in the way of connection.
Well, and I think it's important to point out the abandonment can be real or perceived.
True.
Doesn't have to be actual.
Right. So this kind of is similar, but fear of being separated from your partner. And I would say, you know, that wound stems from an inability or not having developed the tools to feel independent or confident over relying on someone to make decisions. Or, you know, it's interesting. I once read a study when I was pregnant with my oldest daughter of, you know, ways to prevent teenagers from succumbing to peer pressure. And it was all about giving your kids choices growing up. And that those who weren't given choices, who just did what their parents told them to do, were more likely to succumb to peer pressure because they never developed the skill of critical thinking to make a decision on their own. And I think...
Well, it's not just critical thinking. It's sense of identity. It's assertiveness.
What are my values? How do I make a decision?
Like, right. There's a lot tied up in it.
So when you have more of that confidence and you have that skill set, then you won't be as anxious around a partner because you know, I'm okay. I'm still whole when we're not together, I guess was what I was trying to say. That was a long way. It's all kind of stemmed from that fear of abandonment, but discomfort at being alone for too long. And when we learn to lean into discomfort to understand what am I really uncomfortable with? Maybe I don't know what to do with my time. Maybe I don't know what, if I like hanging out with myself. So I think that's opportunity for some really great self-exploration.
Well, and if you don't do that work, you're going to feel abandoned more often.
True.
Because your partner's going to be annoyed at having to be around you too much of the time, and they're going to want their own space.
Right. And needing space or desiring connection is different than needing space. Mm-hmm. Both are healthy.
Yeah.
And this is one that I see a really big piece that kind of is different than the ones above, And I see a lot of women experience this of not wanting to be a burden, but they feel like they are being a burden, right? That idea of I'm needy. Oh, I fucking hate that phrase.
High maintenance.
High maintenance. You're, you know, feeling that they're needy. And
I just want to say on that point, I think if you're in the right relationship, you are not high maintenance or needy. That it's okay to have needs. Having needs does not make you needy.
Correct.
I think most men aren't even aware of what their needs are or that they can ask for their needs to be met. So when anyone kind of comes at them with needs, they're like, well, I mean, subconsciously, like, my needs aren't getting met. Why should yours?
I think most women know exactly what their needs are and what needs are not being met. I think that's opposite. I remember when we first met, we just talked about this yesterday, actually, early on, it might've been the first few weeks. I remember exactly, we were sitting at my kitchen counter and I turned to you. I said, hey, you know, just so you know what you're getting into here, apparently I'm really needy. And you looked at me, you're like, what? You're not needy. And it was like this aha moment went off of, oh, he doesn't perceive me as needy because most of our needs aligned. And I see often in relationships a disconnect around alignment of needs. So one who has a greater set of emotional needs paired with someone who has less desire for emotional intimacy, it might feel like, well, you're really needy.
Well, I think on top of our needs aligning, you matter to me. So I try and meet your needs.
Oh, thank you, baby. But yeah, that's a big piece. But if it's annoying to you, it's going to be harder for you to meet them.
And also, I mean, that's that enlightened self-interest, right? If I meet your needs, you're more likely to meet my needs and we both win.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to say about feeling like a burden in general is really dangerous. I mean, we know with people with suicidal ideation that feeling like a burden is a short bridge to suicidal attempt. And so you want to be careful and you want to challenge that thought of I'm a burden because it shouldn't be true. I want to say it's not true, but some people might make you feel like you're a burden. If that's the case, you might consider if you're in the right relationship.
I think one of the antidotes to feeling like a burden in relationship is to ensure reciprocity. Mm-hmm. I think it feels like a burden when it's too one-sided. Mm-hmm. And which is tricky because let's say the woman feels like a burden and the man doesn't think he has any needs, it's going to inherently feel imbalanced. So let's all acknowledge we all have needs. Mm-hmm. And the key here is to uncover with curiosity and compassion what they are and then be able to communicate them to our partners so that we can honor them without stepping on triggers in the meantime.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that was a great conversation.
I think it was a great conversation. And I'm hoping that this gives you some insight and indication into where you might be stuck, where you might be feeling there's barriers in your relationship from feeling more honest. Because here's the other way it shows up. I know I don't want to speak up. Because now everything feels like a landmine.
And then you sweep everything under the rug and then the resentment just accumulates until it becomes poison.
Right. And then we know couples wait far too long to receive support and now they're resigned and don't feel like they're even available for learning new tools because it's been so well established. So if this is, you know, giving you some aha moments and you're like, ah, shit, what do I do next? Well, good news is, John and I have our Love Isn't Enough year-long masterclass series, which no point in the year or once you sign up, you can always get access to previous recordings and be available for the live upcoming recordings. You can look at loveisn'tenough.net for that information. And we are also launching into relationship coaching. So if this has given you some indication of where you might need some relational support, you can check out our website as well for that. We'd love to help support you on your journey because we know doing this relationship investment, look at that. I remembered the word I used, not work. It pays off.
It does.
Big time.
Yeah.
Because I know I never thought a relationship could be this deep and this fulfilling.
Well, and we also know if your relationship isn't humming along smoothly, neither is the rest of your life.
Yeah.
It's one of the foundational pillars of a happy, thriving life.
Thanks for this conversation.
You are most welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for investing so much in our relationship. Yeah. I appreciate it.
And thank you for your growth as well.
Thank you.
And that is it for this episode of the Evolved Caveman Podcast. Thank you so much for your time and attention. If you like this, please be sure to rate, review, and share. It's how we grow the podcast and get new listeners. If you didn't like it, you don't have to do a damn thing. Thanks so much. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.